Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Waypoint Radio. It is Friday, May 23rd, 2019. You're listening to episode 238. The Austin's mouth is fucked up edition, so he's not here. Instead, Austin's been a week in LA, and then they went into his mouth and did... Look, Austin, hope he's passed on a message. Get your teeth checked.
Yep.
Like, reliably.
Don't be like
several
Austin.
Several times a year. Don't be... And I'm not even just putting this on Austin. Austin getting his teeth checked, discovering that teeth are a thing that need to be looked at year after year, cared for, revealed how little... And this is not Danielle. Danielle, you are separated from this. Unless you need to reveal something, and then I'll be deeply disappointed. Just how little care the Waypoint staff puts into their teeth. Just deep reveals of, yeah, I haven't been there in like... 8 years? Are you
Oh my god! I floss every day. I go twice a year.
Rob's, how are your teeth?
Went for the first time in like a decade.
A few months ago.
What?
Yeah. Well, so okay. So, but here's the. But here's what's great. Here's what's awesome. Going to the dentist. Is kind of idiomatically terrible, but actually now it's much more like going to the DMV or the RMV to like get your license and plates renewed or something like
so
that.
So also
because but terrible in a way that's primarily bureaucratic, right?
Yeah,
like,
okay.
It's not like I wasn't scared of going to the dentist that's keeping me from doing that. One, I wasn't insured. And so I was like, my teeth feel fine. Do I have like
they're not falling out
$200-$300 for whatever the fuck they're gonna find. So that was like putting me off from doing it. But then I was like, great, now I've got dental insurance. And I call the fucking dentist and I'm like, yo, you take this insurance, right? And they're like, absolutely. Let's make an appointment. I was like, great. And they get in there and they're like, ooh, it's been a while, so we're gonna do a bunch of cleanings and there's some fillings that need to be done. So I get booked for a bunch of appointments. And then, right as like the third or fourth appointment is happening, insurance rejects all the claims.
No.
And says, we're not covering this. And I'm like, wait, what the hell? So I talk to the dentist and I'm like, what, you said this, you took my insurance, so what happened here? And their response was, oh, well, the thing is, we take some plans with this insurance company, but not yours. And there's no way for us to know that until we just like call them and send in the billing code.
Are you
and
fucking kidding me?
Then it turned
me?
Out that you had a different class of plan than the one that we usually take around here. So that'll be $1,000, please.
Yeah, it's fucking fraud at that point.
Yeah, that seems like if you were a lawyer, you would say, "I'm going to sue you," and they would go. Good point. You know what? You don't actually owe that money. But because you're us, it's...
But also the problem is I'm having this conversation while I have like a temporary filling. And so I'm like...
This is...
So I got them to knock a bunch off the bill. So I didn't end up paying. Because I was like, excuse me. Like I did do the thing where I was like, that's your fuck up, not mine.
Mm-hmm.
So they now, they just knocked a bunch off the bill. And then... did the work and finished up. But like, this is what I'm talking about though, is like, even if you have dental insurance, oh, it turns out that your dental insurance only works at like 8 different dentists in Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Awesome. Mm-hmm. That's helpful.
Yeah. We're going all of this with mental health coverage. There's a whole union, not to get too far in the weeds here, but there's an entire union, committee now for mental health benefits to try to get us some more robust mental health benefits. And we're in those meetings with like the chief benefits people and like Cigna, where, you know, they might be, you know, somebody in a Midwest call center who's like, oh, there's an available therapist 8 miles away. And it's like, that probably is awesome if you're in a city with like a car where you get on the highway, you go 8 miles down the road, and in 10 minutes you are somewhere. In New York City, 8 miles might be a 3.5 hour ordeal where you need to take a ferry, you know, to a subway, to a bus, to pay a guy, you know, to like let you cross the bridge to, you know, the Billy Goat's Gruff to something else. So it's like a whole, gosh, just benefits are... or thing.
Did you see that story for this week of the, speaking of like the New York subway, of like the Joker character, this person who is like, I'm summarizing, but the short of it is someone, there's already all sorts of delays with like, you know, public transit in New York. It's a total shit show. And these repairs need to be done.
State of emergency for 3 years or whatever it's been now.
Yeah. But apparently there has been someone going around like, pulling emergency brakes, like fucking things up on purpose and then just like disappearing into the tunnels.
Well, and the way they're doing it sounds amazing. Like, I mean, look, this person is a huge asshole.
Yeah.
But the fact that they were saying this person is doing it from the exterior of the train, like they're hopping as a train is leaving the station, they're hopping on the back and getting access to like some emergency external control box shit that's on the, like last car. And that's how they're like activating the emergency brake system. Jesus. And then they're bailing and running through the tunnels, finding an emergency exit and like vanishing into the ether. And, you know, that's way. I thought it was just somebody like finding a.
Who's saying this?
Like, it was reported on like.
I read it on our goddamn
Gizmodo
website.
Sites.
Yeah. But what's the source is what I'm asking. Because if the source is the actual, MTA,
like, yeah, it was like they handed over a bunch of.
They're fucking up their trains.
Yeah, I honestly.
And just blaming it on the mysterious outsider.
For real. That's how
that would be. That would be truly some Joker twisted shit. Is actually bureaucracy.
It's really just a regular like fuck up employee who's just calling himself the Joker. Like,
that would be a 2019 DC Comics reboot. Earth 4.56 reinvention of the Joker is like, no, the real evil is the bureaucracy. And it's just the Joker is just reinvented as some middle person in the who's just shuffling some papers and they're just having a bad day and you feel bad for them and just figure out your paperwork, Joker. Yeah.
Somebody keeps stopping New York's trains. It turns out to be like a safety inspector who's like, no, you can't. I'm sorry. You can't run this.
You might all like die.
This tunnel needs to be repaired,
and this train is completely unfit for service. You need to take it down. And they're just like,
tune in to issue two when like they take out some of the red tape.
That's where the stuff goes,
honest
right?
To it's God. Like
if only someone crisis can stop on that infinite government regulation.
Truly, I feel like a superhero. Like I'm going up against the worst thing in the universe. Whatever the guy with the beard and the butt, I don't know his name, the big bad guy.
What?
He's got nothing on the MTA. Beard and the butt, you know, he's got like a chin and there's a thing with his butt.
What?
Thanos? Man? Thanos? The big bad guy with the butt?
Okay. Oh, right.
This is your fault, Patrick.
What? What's the Thanos
do you think,
part? Is my fault?
The butt part.
Oh,
that's
I did
all
taste
I know.
That.
You put that.
Fair.
You put that image into the Slack, and now that's what people think.
But I put that image in the Slack because Josh Brolin put it in the Instagram. The IG, please.
The IG. On the gram.
Wait, does it not say Insta anymore?
No, we're on IG now.
Okay.
Or the gram.
You should say the gram.
The egg, you know, the new part of the psychology.
Like you might see, well, it depends on the context, right? So it's like, oh, I put it on the gram or I grammed it, but it's like, oh, my IG is blank.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rob.
Yeah.
Let's bring this full circle.
Yeah.
You finished this week. You published a review of a Total War game, a series that you've had a complicated history with. You've not necessarily liked the last couple of these. We've talked a lot about this new one that you, I think the headline was the best Total War game in a decade, which is quite a claim.
It's, you know, honestly, I forgot that. Like, for me, I think it's really down to, it's certainly within a decade. Like, I think this thing's only close competition is Shogun 2, maybe. But honestly, this might be a series high. I'm not sure. This is a game series that a lot of time, when all is said and done, my playtime can be measured in, like, you know, 100, 200 hours. So it's tough to figure out exactly where this rates after only, like, 40 or 50. But it is definitely one of the best out of the box I've ever seen. And it gets so many things right that other games in the series have screwed up. And I think the thing that really impressed me is just the way it solves the endgame problem, or reimagines the endgame problem.
So what is, like, the endgame problem? Like, you've conquered. Now there's nothing to do. Start a new game.
Yeah, like, I think there's a couple things. Rowan Kaiser, I want to say, wrote a piece about this ages ago, but how it's history.
That's a reasonable assumption, even if you're wrong.
I think he wrote about how history doesn't tend to lead to climactic battles, right? Like, usually the way, like, a conflict pans out is that somebody is, like, beaten in a few decisive battles, and then there's kind of a long, like, mopping up phase as their resistance is slowly, like, broken down and they're conquered, right? So, like, you know, late war, World War II, Germany's not in there with, like, an even shot of winning battles. It's kind of them just getting rolled up in every direction. And that's the way a lot of military conflicts pan out. But a lot of strategy games try to have this, like, photo finish idea of, okay, now you reach the end game and you're, like, a great power. Now things should get really exciting. And that's really in tension with the whole notion of, well, if you're at that point where you're about to basically become an unchallengeable superpower, there's no way to create that dramatic endgame
situation.
There's
no boss fight in a strategy game because it doesn't conform to the same, like, narrative arcs.
Right. And I think this stuff only, I think, gets exaggerated because maybe of the influence of, like, Civilization, where literally there's, like, a finish line and then somebody escapes Earth on a rocket ship to win the game. And so I think a lot of strategy games struggle with this, and it is a tough problem to solve. The way Total War games have sometimes solved it is by introducing some really arbitrary end game events that basically put you at a disadvantage and then force you to claw your way to the finish line. And so in Shogun 2, for instance, once you had basically become the dominant power in Japan, you hit an event called Realm Divide, at which point it was basically like everybody became your mortal enemy and began, like, swarming you. And you just had to kind of ride out the storm and then conquer the rest of Japan against this, like, these massive odds. In Rome 2, they basically would have the Roman Senate banish you as a Roman faction. And then you'd be at war with Rome in the Roman Civil War, and the Senate would just be gifted, like, stack after stack of, like, powerful armies, and you had to kill them. And that's kind of that's a model that this series has used a lot. What happens here is that they made it so that that cycle actually repeats throughout the game. And instead of having one endgame situation that you're building towards where everyone turns against one each other, basically, their solution is, actually, people are going to be turning against each other every step of the way. Like, every time someone climbs a rung of the ladder, a bunch of people are going to want to pull that person down. And that's going to be kind of the structure of this campaign. And as you keep winning through those challenges, the fight to stay on that rung of the ladder just gets tougher. And so what they ended up doing for the end game is, it's more dynamic than a lot of their just fight to the finish end games and other Total War entries. what ends up happening is you declare yourself emperor, which it turns out you can do by accident, by the way.
Accident.
Oh, well, I just didn't, you know, look, I didn't, you know, I just showed up to work. I put in the effort and then, you know,
it happened in
Emperor
Napoleon.
Emperor Rob.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. Just the Pope tripped and, you know, the crown fell on his head.
Happened.
What ended up happening with me is that I ended up fighting with somebody else who was claiming to be the emperor of China. And I was like, damned if that's happening. You know, I'm not the emperor of China, but I'm definitely sure you're not the emperor of China. And so I was in this coalition fighting this faction, the Song. And we ended up laying siege to their imperial capital. And then we ended up storming it because we finally beaten all their armies. And this was the weird thing. Most of their empire was somewhere else in China, but their capital, just because of the vagaries of the way the game had shaken out, was like this weird island of territory they had in the middle of a bunch of like formerly neutral powers. And so it was this weird thing where their entire balance of power, their entire base was somewhere else, but somehow their capital was like on the front line, surrounded by enemies. So the city's right there. We end up like conquering it. I'm the one who storms it. And you get this option. You're warned, hey, this is an imperial seat. Like, this is where a credible claim to the empire has been made. If you keep this city, you're basically saying I'm the new emperor. And I was like, I shouldn't do that. I'm not ready for that. Like, I was definitely not at the whole like claim the emperorship level of power. But here was the problem. I had two options. One was that I could basically just loot the city and leave. And first was going to kill a whole bunch of people. But it would have given me a lot of money. And so I could have just taken a big lump sum payment. It's kind of like the lottery, I guess. Like, do you want to take the lump sum or do you want to, like, you know, invest it? The lump sum was pretty compelling, and I could have done a lot with that money, but instead I was like, this city's pretty awesome. It's like just printing money. Well, minting it, really. But, you know, it's got a lot of really advanced buildings. It generates a lot of money. It generates some nice buffs across the faction. And so I was like, I don't think I'm going to give it back. I think this city makes a very nice addition to my empire, which is not ready to be an empire, but we'll leave it there. So I decided to keep it, and immediately everyone's like, oh, so you're declaring yourself emperor now. And I get this new mission that's like, destroy all the other emperors.
Oh.
And it's like, there's other people who are at that level who are claiming to be emperor of China. And in order to win the game, I have to eliminate them. Like, oh, if somebody else is out there saying I'm the emperor of China, they checklist. Have to be destroyed. Yeah. And so immediately I was like, I guess, well, hold on now. Like, we're still friends, right? Like, we were allies 5 minutes ago. And no. Immediately everyone's like, you lose all your allies, your coalition breaks apart, and then everyone starts turning against you because you have a massive diplomatic penalty against you. And so, like, my bestie in this game, Lady Wu, we had this really long border together that had basically been peaceful. And so I was able to put all my really money-making ventures along that border because it was kind of like my backyard, right? I didn't have to worry about attack coming from that direction. Immediately, I'm looking at that, and I'm like, oh, we got a big problem here. And meanwhile, she's like racing around, snapping up whoever is left that's neutral between us. And I'm doing the same. And it's clear that we're just going to have this brawl now. And what's kind of cool there is it doesn't totally end diplomacy. There's other people still in the game trying to get back into the fight, back into this level. But it's going to be way more expensive to keep people off your back. And you basically do have to eliminate anyone at your level. And so it just turns into this really dramatic and like paranoid finish as you begin trying to eliminate everyone at your level. As the emperor, you do get some pretty cool units.
Wow.
They're really expensive. I couldn't afford them. That was the problem. I was like, this is what happens when you claim the emperorship too early.
Oh, so you get to be, you get this baller title, but you can't use any of the actual benefits, and then everyone fucking hates you.
It's like buying too much house, man. You're like, all right, now what does it take to maintain this empire? Oh, the operating costs are that much, huh? I thought it'd just be fine once I, yeah, so I started being like, yes, we will build the dragon. We'll build the dragon fire archers or something like that. And then I'm like, what do they cost per turn to maintain those archers? And I was like, those guys cost as much as an entire wealthy province generates in a year. Interesting. That's good. So it's a cool solution to the problem, though, because it's credible. Like, you're going to generate those big fights. The end game triggers when there are enough people kind of in your weight class to have those fights. But it doesn't feel completely arbitrary the way I've seen it in other games. And it's really neat how it's of a piece with everything they do through every stage of the game.
Let me ask you this, Rob.
Yeah.
After 1,500 hours of Into the Breach, am I ready for a big girl strategy game like this?
I think it occupies such a different headspace.
Sure.
Is the thing. Like, I think there is a lot to enjoy in a game like this. And this is going to be, as strategy games go, this is pretty accessible. But I think the big difference is Into the Breach is fundamentally about, like, you stare at a chess problem for a long time.
Yes.
And you're like, what is the correct sequence of moves here? In Total War Three Kingdoms, you're doing a little bit of that. You're sitting back and thinking, like, how do I get out of this box that I've put myself in? But at the same time, it's such a dynamic system that a lot of unexpected things can happen that change your calculations really drastically. Like, for instance, say you accidentally execute somebody who turns out to be really important. And
who could say?
Yeah, oops. Like, there was a piece on the board, and you're like, I'm going to capture that piece. I'm going to eliminate it from the board because that thing is a huge danger to me and my empire. So I've got to take him out. Except that piece has, like, personal friendships with those powerful characters in the game. And taking them out means that you have entire countries who are like, you're basically a war criminal, and we're going to put you down. And so that's kind of that's the weird thing about this. A dynamic system like this is way more suspenseful in some ways. I think this is as good a place as any to climb aboard, but it's such a different headspace than, like, the tactical puzzler, right? Because the solutions here aren't really elegant. This isn't, oh, I'm going to find, like, the flawless victory and that's what I should be striving for. This is more like, I can win this with 80% casualties, and that'll be good.
Yeah. Fair.
All right. Well, Rob's full review of the game is up on the site now. You can check that out. Also, update from Aaron Gordon over at Jalopnik. New York's brake-pulling subway supervillain has delayed more than 740 trains.
Damn.
This is a good lead to a story. This is how you get me to read about the fucking New York subway, which I hear way too much already about through Twitter because too many writers I follow are in New York.
This is a problem with media, right?
We all suffer.
Yeah. Well, this has been one of the explanations for, like, other tangent. Like, Bill de Blasio, like, already, like, starting with, like, a very low floor. Is his problem is, like, all the political reporters live in New York, don't like him, and so don't even give him the kind of arc or a chance that, like, most politicians, even ones that people don't think have much of a shot, because all the people covering him already live in New York and don't like him. Jerry Lee Heath almost caught him. He was standing right there. It was 3:51 p.m. last Sunday. Heath, a train supervisor on duty at Times Square, got a call from Rail Control Center, the operational brain of New York City's subway system, according to an incident report from that day. That gets away the narrative Jalopnik, even though that's accurate. Someone waiting for a Brooklyn-bound train of Fulton Street in Lower Manhattan alerted staff that they had seen someone riding along the back of a departing Uptown Express train. Maybe Heath could make it to the platform in time, if the person was still clinging to the back of the train. 2 minutes later, Heath was on the platform as the train edged on to the station. Into the station, he spotted someone just inside the rear cab. The safety cables were detached, and the rear door of the train was open. It was him, the person who had been nefariously triggering emergency brakes for months, with the sole intention, apparently, of being a pain thousands upon thousands of butts.
Yep.
That's a good line. Anyway, there's a explanation of this incident report from Aaron Gordon and Rich Lopnick. It is, I am enjoying, you know what, if I have to listen to people complain about the subway, give me a little bit of drama and I can get into this. Danielle, you've been digging into, I don't know, maybe it's dramatic or not. You've been playing a horror game. Layers of Fear.
Yes.
Two,
part two.
The new game. The new game from the studio who I keep, they made a game called Observer. I've been playing a game called Observation, and yet I keep calling it Observer because I am mixing them up in my mind. But Layers of Fear 2 is a sequel to sort of their initial breakout hit. From like 3 years ago, I want to say, something like that.
Something like that. It may have actually been, I think I was at Polygon at the time, actually, when I first played it. So
maybe 4 years ago.
Four, possibly five. Mm. One of those. Okay. This Bloober team, and they actually made a PS4 launch game called Basement Crawl, which wasn't very good, that they then remade into a pretty cool Bomberman-esque game, then started making these like really, I think, fun and interesting and very colorful and extremely unsubtle horror and sci-fi walking simulator with puzzle elements types of games. So yeah, Layers of Fear. Then they made Observer, and that was, I think, 2017. And then now,
yeah,
we're here.
A huge leap, like between, yes. I played Layers of, like, put like an hour of Layers of Fear and was sure. Like, this is fine. The aesthetic didn't do much for me and it wasn't scaring me that much. So I just sort of moved on. But yeah. Observer, I found to be just way more gripping, much more character driven, and
more mechanical.
I liked
too.
Observer quite a bit.
Yeah, yeah, same. I loved it. I wrote a piece on it when it came out about how effective it was at being like a really depressing cyberpunk kind of experience, and much more mechanically deep as well. Like, I'm not saying it was like systems driven or anything like that, but there were
you had more to do.
Yeah,
there was a lot of detective elements where you were going into rooms and piecing together what happened. So it wasn't so much as in a lot of these kind of horror games where it's like just you walk into the room, you wait for the scary thing to happen, and then you sprint to the next area, which is fine. Like, that's I am not going to denigrate the aesthetic scare Jump Factory horror game. I love those too. But Observer was nice because it seemed like it was there was more for the player to do, even if it was like pretty surface level, but it just felt like you then engaged with the both aesthetic of the world and like the material things it was trying to say about that world more interestingly.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. I think Layers of Fear 2 is a little bit of a split the difference, at least thus far. Again, I'm 70 minutes in. According to Steam, I have played 70 minutes. Patrick, I got to a point where I kept dying, and then I was like, all right, it's like 8:45. I should probably leave the office.
That's like the worst thing you can possibly say about a horror game is like I died a bunch of times.
I don't actually think it's that bad, but I did die a couple times, and I was at the office late. So I was like, all right, fuck it, I'm going home.
So hold on.
Fair.
My impression of Layers of Fear has always been that it was kind of like somebody looked at PT and was like, cool, that seems popular. And we're just like, let's rock and roll with that.
A little bit, yeah. The whole thing about it was doing that certainly.
It was an artist, right?
It's like a mad artist, like a mad painter. Yeah. You're exploring different themes of his life and things like that. The thing that I thought was cool about Layers of Fear was that it is playing on sort of like, you look here and then the scripting or whatever will change the room. So if you look somewhere else, actually the entire room or the entire structure would change on you. It is just a trick. Obviously, it's not like a brilliantly like restructured repuzzling that you actually have to kind of figure out or anything, but it was an effective trick.
It's cool. Like the whole like what if the portrait of Dorian Gray could reshape reality is a cool concept. But what I'm interested in here is like how does one keep dying that early in the game, right? Because, like, a lot of these things, especially if they're a little more on rails, they're more about, like, evoking that sense of, whoa, that's a crazy fucked up thing you just saw. Wild. Yep. Feels spooky. Sorry, not to be so dismissive of an entire,
that's what it is.
Entire wow. subgenre yeah. well, of horror.
Here we
tell
are.
How you really feel, Rob. Thanks.
Look,
don't hire Rob to consult on your fucking horror game.
or maybe do hire me, because, like, I'll be real with you. Yeah. You'll know.
Yeah. Wow. You'll know he turns that around to drag me. God wow. damn it.
Master of dragging.
But my the question emperor. Is, like, I didn't hear, so, like, Layers of Fear I heard was scary, but not necessarily, like, in the, we'll constantly try to kill you in the way, like,
Outlast?
Oh gosh, what was that horror game where you're journal? Yes, Outlast. Perfect. You knew. Yes, exactly. Where Outlast continually just wanted to fuck you up and yeah. kill you and force you to restart.
Especially that second.
I'm curious, like, yeah. So I'm curious, like, how is this one basically killing you off, like, so much that early in the game? What's
there
it,
are
what's
some
it
fail
doing?
States. I'm also, I don't know how long this is. The first one was not very long. I think it was 2 hours, something like that. I actually didn't finish it, but then I, of course, one of the reasons it took off is because it got popular with streamers, and so I've watched a lot of streams of it. I don't mean to make this sound as if it's super difficult. There are failure states, basically, and I don't want to make it sound as if, like, I'm so frustrated with it. I literally, like, died, like, 2 or 3 times and was just in the office late. So this is not, like, an indictment of this game, like, oh, it's annoying and sucks and throw it out the window or anything like that. What it's doing, I think, is doing a lot of that let's evoke thing, let's evoke horror, and I should probably set this up. This one is set in a I actually think much more interesting world than the first one. The first one was just sort of a mad mansion with a mad artist who, you know, had gone, obviously, with all of this stuff, content warning for mental illness and all of that. This is not going to be subtle. It's not going to be sensitive to things about mental illness. So, like, let's put that out there. But you're on a cruise ship. You're an actor. Like a famous
speed
actor.
Too, baby.
No, I know. Exactly. It's about that subtle. And you are under the purview of a mad film director instead of a mad artist this time, who is all about controlling you, who is all about sort of making you create characters and things like that. So it's sort of examining those elements a little bit. And you are going through this cruise ship. At first, you're kind of going through cabins and, you know, you're picking up little photos and mementos and clues that are telling you a bit about the story. Then you go into a sort of a backstory element that has to do with children and a pirate ship. It's all these, like, weird nautical themes kind of being thrown at you, which I found really interesting and really cool, actually. Because it is doing a lot of the same things as Layers of Fear 1, but in a, I think, much more interesting and less explored territory, perhaps, at least in terms of the actual physical territory. Being on a boat is weird. Being on a boat is like a weird singular. It's like you have this tiny little world that is separated in a lot of, like, very real ways from the rest of the world. So a lot of bizarre, fucked up things can happen, basically, which is already somewhat interesting in its own. There's a little bit of, like, Titanic vibes, like, oh, you're on a luxury cruise liner in a, you know, in the past, in history. It's not all the way back to 1912 or anything, but it is.
Are there other people? Are you just like, I'm the only person on this ghost ship? Like, what? How?
Sort
how
is of.
How does it, like? Okay.
Okay.
Sort of. You're definitely
oh,
like.
So you don't want to spoil. Is it something you don't want to spoil? Like how the premise, like, sets up? Or I'm just trying to figure out. Like,
yeah.
Because these games being, like, sounds, more on the yeah. low more on the low budget side, like, try to contrive ways for the player to be by themselves. So, like, an observer, for example,
yes.
where, like, you're a detective that's going around knocking on doors. You're in a like a really lower class marginalized neighborhood in which there's a lot of drug use. And
they spent all their money on Rutger Hauer.
They really
well,
did.
Hey, and well, and well it's got, they spend their money on what is, like, their most effective strength, which is, like, aesthetic and visuals, right?
Yeah.
And so and that's not necessarily, like, a nice, fully featured character who can talk nicely. It's other things. It's, like, really weird imagery. So anyways, like, this is all to say, an observer, everyone's door is closed.
Yep.
Like, you're going into very few rooms. Like, you can go through this, like, biggish space, but you're, like, knocking on doors and you're getting a lot of voice acting. Like, they, and it works. Like, you don't ever feel like it's the kind of thing in a video game where, like, well, geez, this character can jump, but like this convenient bike is just something I can't get around.
Yep.
Narratively, it fits for what they're going for, and it's also within the realm of the scope of the game. Like they find a way to do both. So I guess that was me getting at like, yeah, what is their trick this time to pull that off?
Yeah, absolutely. A part of it is being on a ship and being in these really confined spaces in a lot of cases. Part of it is, I'll just say there's a lot of mannequins being used.
God damn.
In a way that is very
condemned,
like...
Condemned, baby. Condemned.
Oh, yeah.
More mannequins.
But also rage.
Mannequins are scary as shit.
Also rage. Good. There's a lot of the use of sort of like lighting and staging and blocking in a very deliberate way. Like you are an actor being prepared for a role and or maybe acting in a role. It's not always entirely clear when you're on stage and when you're not on stage, basically, in this game. And so there's a lot of stuff about like, oh, this actor is blocked here. This actor is blocked here. And there's a lot of use of mannequins. There is some animation. There is some character animation, maybe a little bit more than Layers of Fear 1. But again, yeah, it's not a ton of character animation. It's not a ton of like people talking. There's plenty of dialogue and voice acting, but not as much, you know, you're not watching right. lips move as much, which is, of course, a technical limitation. I actually looked at the credits briefly, and it does look like a very small team, again, made this game, which I think is consistent with their previous games as well. Like a pretty small team, pretty limited resources. And I do think they're doing a lot with those resources. I was freaking out, and I was in like a well-lit office, you know, with my headphones on, playing the game, you know, yesterday evening in the office, and I jumped and I screamed a little bit, and I'm sure I scared the crap out of the second floor, which is just fine.
She's just looking at teenager Instagram.
That's right.
You would be scared too.
You'd be scared too. Okay, friends? But yeah, I do think it's effective. I love the setting. I love the whole idea of like being on a ship. And of course, I love the maybe not very subtle approach of like, what is it to create a character? And what is this crazy director doing? And all this kind of stuff. Cheesy, not subtle, but I think well done and effective thus far.
That's what those games, I mean, like, yeah. Observer is also not, so I think it has like some interesting things to say, but it is certainly pulling out a sledgehammer as it does so,
yeah.
Which is fine because like maybe this is low hanging fruit for the horror genre. One in which time and time again, the easy route is taken because the presumption is, well, you're just here to, as Rob says, like this is why Rob has this response, because the genre is popularized and is you know, for good reason. Really being just like shallow and like, oh, it's weird. And it's a jump scare and you get some violins and like, that's it. And it's like, so part of like a response to an Observer, an Amnesia or Soma is like, damn, like when someone just takes a little bit of time to like try and do some like interesting character and story work with these, it shows how much room the genre still has to grow. Like we're seeing this in film a lot in horror the last like 5 years or so, you know, Babadook, Hereditary, movies of that ilk, in which you start to see a response of like, well, what do we call this new wave of horror films? Like art horror? Or it's like, nah, it's just a horror movie. And just the genre has largely been popularized as Freddy, Jason
X,
and jump scares.
Yeah.
But like, there's nothing inherent to the genre that prevents it from being more interesting, but I like what the Bloober team does, which is like, well, we're gonna give you just enough, and we're not pretending we're like more high-minded like Soma. Like Soma's really trying to use the genre to like say something really deep about the human condition and something existential, whereas like Observer and Layers of Fear seem a little more like, well, here's enough to keep you going, but like don't necessarily get too caught up in the details necessarily.
Yeah, it is very much like a theme park ride, but it's like a, to put a very, very fine spin on it, it's more of a Disney theme park ride than a Universal theme park ride, which is to say, maybe that's not an entirely fair assumption, but there's always a story behind every element of like a Disney ride. There's always like, if you look at it from this angle, there's like seven little, you know, bits of the mise-en-scene that will tell you a little something extra All right, let's just say like a Disney theme park ride versus like a Six Flags theme park ride. Like there's always like a story behind it. There's always a little bit of attention to detail put into every little element.
There's like a little more craft behind like the whole experience as opposed to just like, there's a fucking dinosaur and it's going to come out and it's cool as shit because dinosaurs are cool.
Yeah.
Which is true. And sometimes that's fine.
That's more than fine. This is not like a, oh, this is better. It's just, this is an approach to it, right?
What, Rob? What?
Rob's not happy.
No, I was actually curious about one thing. Actually, quick aside.
Please.
Just small thing. I didn't get this off my chest about Rage 2. There's mannequins fucking everywhere. Okay, this is the other thing about like, whoa, this apocalypse is crazy. Like, look how fucked up things are. These, you know, apocalyptic cultists have put like TVs on the heads of mannequins and use them for target practice. That's wild. What an extreme world this is. And there is one car, the Rolla, in Rage 2, which literally its model always has like a mannequin like just draped across the top of the roof, but not secured in any way. It just won't come off. Like it's like there's a like somebody dropped a mannequin on the roof and it just like it just rides there.
It melted
and,
there a like, little bit.
Oh yeah, my maybe. God. Okay, like further tangent. Last weekend, my wife and I were going to a graduation party for a member of our extended family, and we're pulling up in the car to like take a left, and I look over to my right, and you know someone pulls up into the lane to go straight, and you know I'm taking a left turn, and they've got something strapped to the top of their car, and it's a lawnmower, like there's a Home Depot not that far,
okay.
Like they went there, clearly bought a, you know, we had a lot of rain, grass is turning into a safari in days. So, you know, went and got himself a lawnmower. And I'm looking at it. He kind of looks at me, kind of nods, you know, does that thing while you're waiting at a stoplight. And I look closer at the lawnmower.
Oh, no.
Nothing is strapping this down to the car. That I can tell. And then now he's weirded out more because I'm staring for a long time at this point. Like, trying to, like, am I losing my mind? Like, where's the strap? He's got his windows all the way up. And it's like, usually, like, if you got a strap around it, you got to roll it down a little bit because you got some rope or something. You don't want to cut it. I can't find anything. And I pointed that out to my wife and I was like, can you look? Like, what am I missing? And she's like, I don't think that lawnmower is strapped down. And it's at that moment where, like, maybe we should say something that, like, the, you know, the left turn signal comes on first. We go. And I take the slowest left turn signal of my life. I was like, I need to know how this ends. Like, this seems like the kind of thing where this man could just go into the middle of the of this crossing, and a lawnmower is just going over the car, and like it stays on fine, and we go to our left, and like she's has the window down, craned out. Like, what's the conclusion to this story? And he goes out of view, and it's haunted me for days.
We're never gonna know.
I'm never gonna know. Like, okay. Did he have it? Was it invisible tape? Okay. I don't know.
Is there a possibility that it was secured via a cable running under the trunk lid? Like, did you get a view of the back?
Oh, like
window?
In the back? Oh, yeah. Right. So, yeah, it's possible. It's possible. It's definitely. It's. I'm just saying, like, upon like
also,
a 30
was it
second.
Standing up, like someone's about to push it, or was it flipped on its back so that?
Well,
like,
no,
the
it was
blade
in the box.
Still.
Like, it was in the box. Like, it was like he had just bought it. Like, the lawnmower wasn't even removed from the box.
Even
it was
weirder.
Like, I gotta go home. Put oil in it, and usually if it's a box, like, it's going to be a pretty obvious cable, like you're doing a Christmas tree, through the windows and over the, I don't know, man, I hope I'd, you know, I'm haunted.
Honestly, yeah, this is.
I'm going to go to one of those Reddit, like, short, scary story threads, like, this is the one I'm going to put out there. Like, where's the punchline? It's like, no, that's it. Like, that's I'm up at night wondering what happened to this goddamn lawnmower.
The whole time I
find out.
I never did find out. The whole time I pictured, I don't know why, but I pictured a riding lawnmower with a mannequin riding it, just like phantom mannequin, like if one hand on the wheel, like looking at you, has a John Deere cap on, just like the whole time. I don't know why. That's just how I pictured this beautiful
story. If Rage 2 had that as a vehicle you could ride around, it'd be more interesting than anything in that game currently.
But the thing that I was actually going to ask, I'm just curious about this. Sometimes when people use, like, the 1930s as a setting, There's kind of a weird, stereotypical, old-timey newspaper man voice that everything ends up written in. Like, Bioshock trades in this very lightly, but in general, the writing's pretty strong in the Bioshock games, and characters don't just devolve into patter. But I am kind of curious, is this a game that feels like it's set in the 1920s or 30s, or does it feel like it's a game set in, like, kind of a cartoonish imagining of the 1930s if it were like a radio drama?
So it's very funny that you say that, because there is one of the voice actors, the person who's playing your agent, who, you know, you get notes, you get little things, you get objects that like trigger up an audio cue that are like, oh, you're remembering this thing happening, who is like the most Brooklyn ass, just like, hey, what's he gonna do, kill ya? Like, this is your agent, you know, kind of talking about this, like, you know, quote-unquote nutty film director who's this weird recluse who makes beautiful art, but like, it's fine, you know, he's weird, it's fine. And that is very much that, the, like, newspaper man, you know, sort of thing going on. There's a little bit of the cartoonish going on here, and I will say, it is the sledgehammer approach, for sure. Yeah. Like, very much the Team Bluebird, like, this ain't subtle. Like, nothing about this is subtle, but we're having a lot of fun with imagery and a lot of fun with, like, spooky things happening in this weird ship that might actually just be a stage, but maybe it's also a ship, and who knows, you know, because all sorts of weird things are going on here. But it's very much my shit, and I am very much enjoying it thus far, even though I did die a couple times. So there are those sequences that are like, oh, you can fail this. It's auto, you know, saving.
You need to run around the corner, and you didn't do it fast
exactly.
enough.
Exactly. It's exactly stuff like that. Although, like, the sequence before this that was sort of was a possibility to fail, I got through it just fine in, like, 5 minutes. You know, died a couple times, restarted, whatever.
Right.
Right. I'm hoping that's the case for this sequence. I'll let you all know if I don't finish this in 5 minutes of actually just, you know, sitting down and being like, okay, what do I have to do? Okay, I did the thing. Which, again, like, I don't mind these types of things as long as they are not the norm in the game. I'm fine with, like, a small pace, you know, like, change of pace. Okay, there's a failure state here, that sort of thing. As long as it doesn't keep me stuck for more than a few minutes. Because at that point, we're gonna have issues, Team Bloober. But again,
well, that's, you know, yeah. that was a lot of the problem with, you know, Soma.
Yes.
And
yeah,
like it's monster design, which it's been long enough. Like, I feel like we gotta be pretty close to hearing what that team is up to. Which I know they have two project development. One was supposed to be horror and one non-horror. Obviously, my preference is to hear about one of those over the other.
Yes,
but I'm super curious to see. Because so much of the horror genre was defined by Amnesia,
yes,
to a degree that it infected Soma. Whereas Soma should have been more of like an evolutionary response of like, hey, well, this is what Amnesia did, and the genre followed. Soma just kind of doubled down on a lot of, and I love the story in Soma. It's one of my favorite stories in video games ever, quite easily. Go download the version of the game now that like lets you basically turn off the monsters and like just go enjoy that story. But I am so curious to see like what their solution is, or like what they think, where the genre goes from here, because even in games like Layers of Fear are still building and playing off things that Amnesia sort of like laid the gauntlet down for so many years ago. So
yeah, absolutely.
Well, we'll have to check in when you get a little further. I just finished Observation, another horror game, and I'm looking forward to jumping into, you know, it's May. The horror time.
Yeah. Springtime in the air. Death in your TV. Yeah.
Well, the director of Hereditary does have their summer horror movie coming out pretty soon. So I'm excited about that. But before we take a break, like I mentioned, I just wrapped up Observation, a game I mentioned earlier this week. The new game from No Code, the studio that did Stories Untold.
Oh, great game.
The sort of like interactive fiction game with a really elaborate aesthetic layer around it to sort of give a lot of trappings to you typing into a computer terminal. The setup for Observation is, and I'm going to try and make sure I keep saying Observation instead of Observer, you know, basically you're on a space station. Imagine if you were HAL 9000, right? No.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
9000?
You got it.
Right? Okay.
I think so.
Yeah, if you were Hal and you could control the security systems, hatches, and you're attempting to help the people that are on the ship or not. Sort of like the basic setup. But what I want, I finished it, but Rob, you just started it. I'm curious how you have taken or not taken to it so far.
So one, I think I might have been a bit ruined by your observation that you can, your note that basically you can reject commands or make
my theory of what the game might be. And it turns out it's not that at all.
So the problem is I am now basically role-playing that as, if not maybe a malevolent AI, one that just relentlessly fucks with people. Like, I am the underpaid customer service rep of this game, where just every response, I'm like, could you repeat that? Like, somebody asks, could you tell me if module 8 is connected to module 9 still? And I'm like, power in module 8 is active. And like, that's not what I asked. And I was like, air pressure, nominal. And so I can't, like, now I can't help myself. And the other part of this is sometimes there's a bit of like hidden object in this where it's, you need to find the thing and hit the switch so I can, and the camera panning is really slow because it's thematic, like, oh, it's a security camera. But also there's a few times where I'm accidentally fucking with this poor character just because I'm like, I don't know where that switch is. Give me a second. And like, there's times where,
so that's the weird disconnect of the game where they, because it's a video game and they want the player to like discover things and find them on their own, but that clashes up against like the scientific premise, the technological advancement that has allowed this space station to exist, which is like, well, at the point where there's like a wide-ranging AI that is, can speak and is taking care of like automating all sorts of systems and subsystems and largely making the existence of humans on here just the maintenance of the AI, it seems awfully goofy
in the game
where they're like, hey, Sam, which is the name of the AI, is like, could you like open that hatch? Which means it's like, it's like Sam knows where the fucking hatch is. Like, they try and give some narrative justification of like, oh, a bunch of your systems are offline. You know, you don't have access to like your history or whatever. But that may be true. But nonetheless, it's like at a certain point you can swap to a sphere and like you get free roam around the space station. And it's so tough to control, which is like fun because it feels like thematically interesting. But like, again, practically against the premise of the game, it's like, Sam, you incredible achievement of human history knowledge culminating in the existence of this someone who can like take care of these things for us. Like, could you go across the room and open the hatch? Is like, sure, doink, 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 doink.
Yeah.
Wait, sorry, I locked it. I did the wrong sequence. Like, I gotta start this over. Unlock, open hatch. Thanks. It's like, well, and the game doesn't acknowledge it at all. The game is like, doesn't do enough to be like, Sam, you fucking asshole. Like, what is your issue?
Yeah.
It's weird. Like, this is an entire game basically told from the perspective of like the male robot in The Americans, where like you've got a limited range of jobs and you're not very good at any of them. But like, by God, everyone has to wait for you to ploddingly go about your business. And like, there's simple, like, could you open this door? And I'm like, I'm really sorry. I think I left my keys. I don't know which door, like, is this the button? I can't. Oh shit. And so there's that part of it. I think the other funny thing though is, think about how much more elaborate this game became because of like this choice about presentation, how you interact with the game. And I understand why. It's very cool looking game. It's got that kind of menacing beauty that like Quaron's Gravity has, for instance.
Yes.
Right? The stark bright light of light, like coming in through a space station viewport or something like that. It's got all of that. But at the same time, the weird thing is there's moments where you like flip into like the station layout view where like there's just a big map of like what's there and what systems are in each module and all that. And I'm thinking, this whole thing could have been done with like a Duskers type interface and might actually run a little more naturally if you were just basically the AI looking at a schematic and the human running around, you know, kind of in this anthill, in this ant farm view of the space station. That's harder to sell, right? You want those like slightly spooky and menacing screenshots, and you want to like humanize the character who is in here, see her face, you know, like see that there's a person, not just a voice on the radio. But it is interesting to me because there are times when I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, well, once I've learned the layout of a space, going isn't as it like it's both a little dull, but also it doesn't make that kind of narrative sense. And you're thinking, I kind of wish I could just flip into like a systems interface, a management interface.
Give me a command terminal.
Yeah.
And like,
yeah,
I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
Having finished it, those problems you have only get exasperated over time. I deeply admire like what it's going for. Like, I think it's a really interesting, like bold way to try and tell this kind of story, but I couldn't help but be like disappointed. And I think the game makes this mistake early on when it gives you the accept or reject choice. It's conveying a level of agency over like what's about to happen, where like all of a sudden I started thinking, oh my God, like, like what Rob, you're doing is role playing. What I was hoping more from the game was like that is going to be the narrative of like, what are you going to choose to do? Like AI, like how are you going to approach the situation? And there's none. There's literally no agency you have throughout the rest of the game. You are just, you know, running down a checkbox and dealing with really cool interfaces. Like, it's an incredible looking game. It is so much fun to flip dials and turn switches. And there, if you like that stuff, there's like a whole sequence at one point where like I'm adjusting 12 different thruster systems and then flipping all these switches along the way. And it's just like, ooh, this is like, it's not that hard.
It's
not
complicated. Busy box.
Exactly. It is.
Yeah.
It is. None of the puzzles are particularly difficult because they want you to just keep moving. Like, there's literally like one sequence where it's like four phases to like turn off this one thing. And I'm like, oh shit. Like, it's a really spooky part. Like, I'm in the end game, like, be kind of weird to get stuck on a puzzle for a while. And the game's like, don't worry, we got you. You are literally just flipping switches for four sequences. You're fine. And like, it was still satisfying because just flipping big physical switches in the game, like, was itself satisfying. And the story is pretty good. But it is not, if the tease I had at the beginning of this week of like, oh, is it, you know, a choice driven narrative over like how you would be as an AI on a ship. This isn't it. The template of this game sets up really well for like, I'd love to see someone try and do something like that. Like, what if you were an AI that like, there's gotta be like a better narrative conceit to set up why you're a bumbling AI. or maybe you're a human that's like pretending to be the AI. Like, I don't know. Like, there's ways you could do that where like, I would love for a game that is choice driven where you're on a space station. There are like 5 to 10 humans and just like, I don't know, like start fucking with them. Like, what would you do in this scenario? I think that'd be pretty cool. And I will say this game has like a several, the cinematography is really terrific in the same way that Layers of Fear and Observer, are smart in knowing what they can and can't do. There's like a number of sequences in Observation where it's just a really tight shot on like a character and you can't see much of what is going on. But like in the same way that Stories Untold is just like a shot of a desk and then just like spooky lights and good music. Like, there'll be moments where like a lot of shit is happening around this character in the station or in space. And the implications of it is like terrifying, and it's like a kind of a grip the table sort of thing, but you're not actually seeing very much. Mm. Or there's another sequence where like one of the big reveals of the game is literally just like an extremely slow camera pan out where you're like, oh, am I supposed to hit spacebar to like go to the next scene? And it's like, no, like they want you to sit and wait. And it goes on for like 4 minutes, like a really long time to be like on a slow zoom out. By the end of it, you're like, ah, fuck, okay. Whoa, all right, this is, okay, the scope of what is going on here is a little more than I expected. So I think it's a very smart horror game. I really like the fact that that team, No Code, is trying to tell these stories in different ways, because I think there's like a very easy path to have told a, you know, AI story on a space station where things go wrong. And I thought this was a novel way to do it that runs into some limitations, but I'd love to see other teams take a crack at the same concept. So I'd be curious to see where it's not that long, Rob. It's like, you know, 4 hours ish. And at some point it's probably worth just like, anytime you're not quite sure what to do, just like have a walkthrough. Like there's nothing satisfying about it. There are multiple moments where I was just like, this is not fun. Like I'm not enjoying like the game saying like, go find R7. I'm like, I don't know, man. Like I just, okay. It feels like the game is actually like 2 hours long, but there's busy work that gets you to four.
Yeah.
Patrick, I have a very urgent question. Because it's bothering me since we talked about Layers of Fear, and I was like, paintings, art. I swear to God, there was a horror trailer we saw not that long ago that we both got really into, and it was about some sort of like modern art gallery that was fucking haunted.
Yeah, that was from the director that did Nightcrawler.
Right.
Jake Gyllenhaal. I forget what that movie.
Did that come and go?
It did. It went on Jake Gyllenhaal Art Asshole. That's what I'm going
to type asshole.
In.
Art Asshole. Art Asshole.
Yeah,
Velvet,
Chris
Velvet Buzzsaw.
Velvet Buzzsaw?
Yeah, it came. Velvet Buzzsaw came out on Netflix. It's from the same. So Jake Gyllenhaal to. I'm glad that like Spider-Man's coming out so people can be. I think people know that he's a good actor, but I don't think people quite realize like how unbelievably good he can be. And like the range, like his ability to like be in a B movie, but like with A plus caliber acting, which is what like a movie like Nightcrawler is.
Tony Collette's in this too.
Yeah, there's a lot of great character actors in Velvet
John
Buzzsaw.
Malkovich.
What would you call the Sands of Time?
Hmm?
Prince of Persia.
You know what? Thank you, Kata.
Look, you are right. You busting up Jake Gyllenhaal for wanting to make a buck? He's like, yo, here's my Disney moment.
Sometimes you find yourself bald in Bulgaria, making a pile of shit. All right?
Okay, so I'm not going to be here next week for Waypoints.
Uh-huh.
So we got to do this right now.
Okay.
That Timothy Oliphant interview in Rolling Stone is, so there's been a lot of like tasty excerpts being passed around Twitter because he's doing this press tour for the Deadwood movie. It's a good interview. Those excerpts you're seeing are funny.
It's from like a TV critic, Alan Sepinwall, who does like really good like TV critic work, just FYI.
But what was really striking to me is also just the way it's a profile of a guy who's really good at his job, but also it is just a job, which is so fascinating. Like you expect... Timothy Oliphant isn't like a huge star, but he's a very well-regarded actor, a bit more than a character actor.
He's in between, like, has so far said, I'm not going to do one of these Marvel movies, but you can still see him doing it at some point. But even in the interviews, he'd be like, well, this is some bullshit, isn't it?
and that's... It is so funny to see him talking about, he's worked on some really good series, but what's interesting is he doesn't do any of that shit where he's like romanticizing like the craft or like how amazing the work is. It really is a guy, you are asking a really successful person about their work and they are responding as if they are describing how their shift went last Thursday at the store.
Yep.
And I think that makes it a really fascinating interview because a lot of times when you see these press tour interviews, you end up with actors who are maybe giving what they think people want to hear. They elevate the idea of what acting is and what it is to work on these projects. And here's Oliphant being like, yeah, this is a great show. Working on it sucked.
Yeah.
Hated it.
I came across. Well, I follow Alan Sepinwall. He's a terrific TV critic. I just read everything he writes about TV, even for the shows I don't watch, because his sensibilities line up with mine. But so he did this. Most of these quotes are coming from the interview that he did on set of the new Deadwood movie. And so I'll get to my quote, the one that like got passed around yesterday, and this one that I also posted last night on our Discord, in which Alan asks. I've heard many conflicting accounts of the cancellation over the years of the movie, of the show Deadwood, which only had 3 seasons, but for convoluted reasons, like, didn't go on any further. including one that pinned it to a panic that ensued after you bought a new house. Care to clarify? And so Oliphant goes on to say, I'll tell you my version, and I already said this earlier. I fully understand that my memory of how it happened may not be how it happened, even for me. This is a story I've told over the years, and every time you tell it, it changes. And let me preface this with, I've never been one to let truth get in the way of a good story. So if you're holding on to facts and you're going to call me on those facts, go fuck yourself. Which is just so good. And so a little after that, in which Alan's kind of unpacking, because there's really just never been a, like, a great understanding of how, like, what he's getting here is like the way the story goes with Deadwood is that, like, Oliphant bought a house because he heard they got a raise and they were going to go on for a couple more seasons. And then, like, he got a call from the showrunner, David Milch, that said, like, oh, we're canceled. And so then he told his agent, oh, we're canceled. And then the agent told, like, the other actors, oh, we're canceled. When actually, like, HBO was just in the middle of a negotiation and hadn't really canceled it. But at that point, there had been so much fire over, like, oh, we're canceled, that the show just got canceled kind of by accident and miscommunication.
Oh, God.
And so, Oliphant had bought this house. And so Alan ends up, as a follow-up, asking, did you wind up selling the house? And he goes, no, I'm a glass half full type of motherfucker. And I said to myself, well, thank God I didn't know they were going to cancel the show. I would have never bought this house. And let me put this on the list of why these people owe me. What do we have to what we have to thank for this is the villain in Live Free or Die Hard and a fucking bald head in Bulgaria shooting hitman. That's what that phone call led to. How about the villain in Die Hard? I said, sure. And they're like, do you want to read the script? And I said, I get it. I'm in. I just bought a house. Did you not hear? They just canceled my fucking show. Yes, I'll do it. What about the video game adaptation? Yes to that too. I'm in. Oh, I've got to make up some TV money. You know what though? Those experiences were equally valuable. Oddly enough, those kinds of experiences, perhaps arguably more valuable than these, you know? You find yourself bald in Bulgaria, do some piece of shit that will get you up a little earlier in the morning and make you work a little harder. Which are just words of wisdom that we should all live by. And also, I need to watch the show Deadwood because all I know about it is that it has a lot of swears. And I love Timothy. Justified is a great show. And so I need to get around to watching that before. Well, I guess the movie's coming out in like really soon. Very soon. So I guess I'll be a little behind.
It's a great show.
With Timothy words, why don't we take a break? We'll come back in just a moment.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And we're back, because Danielle, we're only back. We're otherwise just going to say we're at a break, let an ad roll, just roll around in that sweet, sweet money, buy a house, go be in a hitman movie. But then Danielle said, I've got this shout out. I need to get it out of my system. Danielle, what's up?
I want to tell you a little bit. I mean, I could connect this to a bald thing. You know, Eggman is from Sonic.
right? But he's a doctor, thank you.
Yeah, excuse me, I'm very sorry. You know, that got him up in the morning. You know, was trying to become a doctor. Okay, I'm playing Team Sonic Racing, and I know maybe not everybody's excited about Sonic these days. Maybe not everybody's excited about kart racing these days. But I really love the Sonic Racing games. Sonic and All-Stars Racing, I believe, was the name of the previous series from the previous generation, which were really awesome kart racing games. Really, really fun, colorful, lots of cool tracks with lots of secrets and shortcuts and cool things like that. And this is the sort of modern version of that. It's a new game. I think it's out today, maybe yesterday, 2 days ago.
Came out
ago?
This week, I think.
This week,
yeah.
Yes. I just want to give it a shout out because it's just a good-ass kart racing game. A couple hours in, so I can't speak yet to one of the things that I love the most about the previous games was how much just general Sega nostalgia was in them. You had like the Samba de Amigo characters and tracks. You had Space
last one
Channel
had
five.
Was it Ryu from Shenmue, and he was like going around in a forklift, right? Like,
yes,
that was his car.
Which is so good. It's so good, especially if you're like a Dreamcast era person, like I absolutely am. Love my Dreamcast, etc.
Give me a Choo Choo Rocket. Are they in there?
Oh my god, I love Choo Choo Rocket. I don't know. I don't actually know. So I can't actually speak to how much other Sega nostalgia is in this game. I haven't seen much of it yet, which is a little bit disappointing. Otherwise, they actually sort of revamped a lot of the actual systems of the game. You're on a team now instead of just racing yourself in the sort of adventure mode. You have a team of two other racers. There's a lot of cool little mechanics around boosting and sort of drifting and getting like a slingshot boost, literally like drifting and drafting.
It's kind of like a Double Dash sequel.
Yes,
like the controversial. One controversial Mario Kart game.
right?
The Mario Sunshine of Mario Kart's Double Dash.
Exactly. And which also came out, didn't
they
come out the same
year? They decided to try and do something different with it. Oh no, there's eight other ones we've been playing for the last 20 years.
Yeah, right? Seriously. I like these new innovations. I think they're actually really fun. They're really cool. And there's like a whole adventure mode in the game. So it's not just Grand Prix. You're playing Grand Prix and then also like little one-off stages that are like, hey, get tons of rings, or hey, learn how to drift really, really closely to poles and things like that. That's pretty awesome and pretty cool. So just a shout out. That's been very, very fun playing that. Hoping to play it with my partner this weekend, because she's also a huge fan of the Sonic Racing game. So like I can give an update to the multiplayer, but thus far playing the sort of one player mode has been very fun. I do hope there's more Sega nostalgia and not just Sonic characters, which it's fine if it is. I love Sonic. I love weird Sonic, even if it's like slightly shitty sometimes. Still
weird,
enjoy
weird
Sonic.
Weird Sonic is my favorite Twitter, you know? Just people out there.
They're all the way
weird
out
Sonic.
There.
Multiplayer, are you on the same team, or do you both have, like, separate teams that, like, you've amassed?
Very good question. Right, I haven't played it yet. I've just been playing the single player thus far. But it's really fun and colorful, and the racing actually feels very fun and very good and has those little tweaks to it that I think are enjoyable.
I think cool.
We'll revisit that.
Hell yeah.
Go ahead, Kato.
I think they need to take the car away from Sonic.
But he's too fast.
He's faster on foot.
You're right. He is faster on foot.
That's
well, Sonic
why.
Are.
I know that
it's it's the Superman problem. You know, you got to give him like a handicap.
Yep.
Sonic R was a game I played a lot and was very bad, but also
Super
I really enjoyed it.
Sonic Racing.
You're
gotta
allowed.
Keep your feet back on the ground. Everybody's Super
you know this
Sonic
song?
Racing. Oh yeah, this is a lot of the Sonic R soundtrack.
Good.
I was also I was a PlayStation kid growing up, but then like later got into the Saturn after I got into the Dreamcast and like realized I'd missed out on like a lot of Sega stuff. So
I had Sonic R on PC.
Whoa. What?
Yeah. I don't, because I never owned a, what was it, a Saturn game?
Well,
yeah,
oh, cause I guess that's back game. When they were doing like those occasional weird PC ports, right?
Yeah.
Like the Final Fantasy VII one published by Eidos. Yeah.
Mm. I don't know weird. Why, but that's where I played Sonic R.
Hey.
I preferred Sonic R Factor.
What?
The Handley model was just way more convincing.
Okay. Kato. You were in our Discord earlier this week. You were pitching Austin on a game, sort of like a Slay the Spire adjacent toward a game called Nowhere Prophet. So why don't you pitch all of us?
Do you like Slay the Spire?
I mean, it was 4 a.m. I was supposed to have gone home hours earlier. Rob walks in and is like, "Why the fuck is everyone here playing Slay the Spire at 4 a.m?
Good thing it was 3 a.m, by the way, because everyone's going to tap out at 3, and then no one left till 6.
Well, you know, I think I like Slay the Spire. I'm waiting for
the
Switch version. I liked what I played. I didn't play a whole lot of it.
Okay, so take the like map level stuff from FTL and the card-based kind of combat from Slay the Spire. You have a very similar thing. Actually, the combat is maybe different and more the deck building aspects of Slay the Spire, I would say. But the Norwar Prophet is this kind of they call it dust punk setting, kind of drawing on Indian culture, and but also with a twist of being like cyberpunk future, but mostly set in desert arid areas, where you are the prophet, and you and your followers are trying to make it to a like promised a space called the Crypt that will, like, you know, that's just like the end state, how you win the game.
That's how you say it, save the world. Yay.
Yeah. But the way that they like set up this, there's this map with many paths and traveling between traveling between crossroads, like traveling point to point. You need a couple of resources. You need food to feed everyone, and also a secondary resource called hope, which is just like, you know, how many, like, if you lose all hope, people start peeling off from your your followers, start like giving up and going away. So, and in between points, you can get into you get FTL or what's the other one I was thinking of just now? Like, BattleTech also does this. Like, you know, you get these like little moments of like story where like you have to make decisions, and depending on the followers that you have, and if you have certain cards in your deck, you will have different options, things like that. And then the way that it's presented, the way that the combat it works out, is that you have two decks. One of them is your followers, and one of them is like actions that you do as the leader. And whenever, if you've ever played like Hearthstone or Magic the Gathering, it's set up the same way, where you like play your followers and they're the ones dealing damage to other things normally. And you don't really have to deal with the enemies on the board as much as you're trying to deal damage to the enemy leader. But in this game, when you lose one of those characters in a combat scenario, they are now wounded. So the next time you go into a combat scenario, they are weaker, and if they get killed again, they die for good. So there's a certain level of, like, in certain situations in Magic the Gathering, which I played a lot of, you will do this thing called chump blocking, which is like you take a very weak creature and you put it in front of a huge creature because it'll soak all the damage and you won't get hurt. And that sort of play is discouraged here because then you're going to lose out on that card in your deck. And once you don't have any cards in your deck and you go to draw a card at the beginning of your turn, you just take damage if there's nothing there. So there's a certain amount of cards that you want to have in your deck so you're not running out and then getting hurt. But also, like, so it's a, and also, like, the way it presents it, it always shows you your followers at the bottom of the screen on the map screen, and like each follower has a distinct name. And when one of the what's it called? When one of the encounters happens, it'll name, if there's an option because you have X follower who's an engineer, it'll use their name in the like dialogue. And so like you start to get more connected to these cards as actual people that are following you. And so it like really twists that, like I'm trying my best to like take care of these, like you feel like a caretaker yeah. of this deck a lot more than like I would ever care or think about the creatures in my Magic deck, for example.
Right.
And it's really interesting. It's pretty hard. They have the art is great. Like it's a really cool, like they do a lot of really cool things with the setting, and what I played was a beta, so it's not out yet. And I only was able to play the first map. Like each map has like a boss at the end of it, and then you're supposed to move on to another map. And I'm not sure how many maps it takes to get to the like end of a run. But it's also a roguelike in that as you do certain actions, you unlock things for both your caravan, which are your followers, which there's like different decks. Like there's a follower deck that is called the Forgotten, which are like mostly normal people that have survived whatever apocalypse happened in this world. There's a deck that's mostly made up of beasts, of animals. Like you're basically like running this like big, like you're like a rancher essentially. and there's like another one that I didn't get to play with as much, which are more like people that had are like bandits, or like there's a lot of stealth elements to them. Ooh. The mechanics are very interesting. It's a very good, very well built like card game, and then also this like wrapper of having to like keep your followers alive is makes for a very interesting tension in the combat.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm very excited to play more of it when it actually comes out, because there's also not only are there different follower groups, but like as your leader, you have like different classes that'll give you different decks for what your leader actions are.
Huh.
And it's got that thing too where you can't just throw out cards out of your deck for your leader deck. Like in Slay the Spire, I think you have to pay some sort of resource sometimes to get rid of things, to like make things a little more streamlined. It's great. It's got a lot there. I'm very excited to see what more gets added to the full game.
You said it's beta. Does that mean it's an early access, or is there like a different way of?
No, it was just like was a closed beta this past weekend, and I think they're running another one. So it's like, go follow their. They have it's up on Steam. You can like on their website. They'll like send out an email for the next thing. I think it's supposed to be an open beta. But the closed beta was just this past weekend, and it ended on Wednesday. So this is more like, hey, pay attention to this for next time, because it's worth checking out when they do go live.
What's it called again?
Nowhere Profit.
Nowhere Profit. I like that.
Yeah.
I've been getting, I've spent a little more time with SteamWorld Quest, which is also nice. Sort of like a deck builder RPG. Like it needs to be my toes before like jumping a little deeper in with like a Slay the Spire type thing. I was kind of cruised through the first like 4 hours without much difficulty, and now it's finally amping that up a little bit, and more specifically giving me like more to do with my characters. And so like like the way it was set up before is like you've got a healer type who does a lot of defensive buffs, you have an attacker type, and you have a magic type. And now I just got this fourth character who is like a lot more interesting and like switches up the dynamics of my style a lot. If you choose, like if you want something that's a little more advanced, like the way this character works is they change masks. And so like, let's say you have a basic attack, like the way SteamWorld Quest combat works is like each card costs a certain amount of points, and there are cards that don't cost any points, but those build up like your point total. So like a basic attack that doesn't do much damage doesn't cost anything, but you're building up a point to accrue that you can use for a card that actually does cost something. And so this one character that I just got, you want them to be switching masks, because it turns like a regular attack into a critical hit if you switch masks. So it's like if you're on like the red mask, but then you switch over to the yellow mask, like it's a much more powerful attack if you're switching, as opposed to just like sticking with the yellow mask. And so like it encourages you then to like think really strategically about the deck you're building. And it's only 8 cards, and you often never have access to more than like, you know, 15 anyway. So you can't like screw up the deck too bad, because they're really putting a lot of guardrails in place, at least early on, to make sure that you'll always end up with something you can use. But like I keep going in and like, okay, how can I like limit what I have so that I'm constantly switching between masks? And like sometimes that mask might be like one I got is one that will gives a buff to another character where like they have a 60% chance of critical hits. And so it's like, okay, switch mask, critical hit buff, and like that sets up the next character for like their sets of attacks. And so it's become a lot more dynamic and interesting in a way that if you like me have not played these types of games, get like turned off or nervous about like card based games, even if like functionally they don't seem that much different than like a regular RPG where you'd be equipping things. SteamWorld Quest does an exceptional job so far of like in the intro area, taking it to almost a boring place where you're like, yeah, I get how this works. Like, okay, like there's not a lot here, and then starts layering in more complexities. So that like I'm excited and fresh and want to engage with them. Whereas if the game had given me this character to start, or said like, here's 6 characters, like pick which one you want, I think I would have gotten overwhelmed and like brushed it aside. Whereas now I'm like, fuck yeah, like let's make this game harder, but a little more interesting to play. So yeah, I'm enjoying my time deeper into to SteamWorld Quest. Let's see. As we near the end here, Rob, I wanted to make sure we're gonna, you know, we're doing this thing. We're gonna shout out some more pieces, stuff going up on the site this week. Do you want to pitch people on Dante's piece that, well, at this point, when this goes live, it went up a couple days ago, but he wrote about Overwatch.
Yeah, Dante wrote about some new skins that came out for the latest Overwatch anniversary event, or coming out for the Overwatch anniversary event. And there's a couple questionable ones in there. One that was talked about in Twitter a little bit was the fact that there is an Academy D.Va skin, which is... her in a school uniform, which has connotations that a lot of people are not wild about, and justly so. But the thing Dante actually focused in on is the fact that they took one of the newer characters, Bridget, and put her in police riot gear. Oof. And his position is kind of talking about how just in making a character skin like this and creating a sort of cartoony, cool-looking riot cop skin for Bridget, aren't you also implicitly kind of celebrating police militarization? And how are you, like, first of all, how are you kind of uncritically releasing that in the world in 2019 when this country is, like, on a daily basis now, seeing national headline stories about police abuses, police violence, police malfeasance? And riot cops are increasingly a sort of menacing presence for any kind of like leftist protest or demonstration happening anywhere in the country. And then the other part of this is can you square the sort of heroic, aspirational nature of these characters, their backstory, with the idea that, oh yeah, and they're also a cop? Because increasingly what we see here is that Overwatch is portraying these characters as noble on the side of justice, being there for the underdog, helping out those in need. And then if you have one of them dressing up as a riot cop, what you kind of have there is, oh yeah, but Bridget loves state violence against civilians. So I think that's sort of the piece he wrote, digging into some of that stuff. And my suspicion is there's not good answers, right? This is kind of the whole thing with creating a lot of skins for characters in games. There's always a weird element of dress up about it, and what is the fantasy about seeing a character presented in this different way? Blizzard gets this wrong, I would say, more than most, right? Like,
in a game that is like, what makes Overwatch so fascinating in terms of like the critical response and like sort of the conversation around it is that on the one hand, you can acknowledge they have like a really diverse, in some ways, not always, cast, and one that tries to like celebrate that diversity and like be an inclusionary game. Like, that's part of their pitch, right? Is that like we're an inclusive game. We're thoughtful about this. This is something that is top of mind when we are creating characters and creating backstories for those characters. At the same time, it seems like every time they do it, they also step in it in a way that's like, what? Like, how? Like, we're at the point, this has happened so many times that you're just ready. Like, all right, cool. But where's the shoe? It's got to drop. Like, yep. There's something out here. And it's just, I find myself surprised that it seems to happen over and over again.
Can I ask if Bridget is supposed to be a cop?
No.
So they just picked this randomly? Like, oh, you know who'd be a cop?
She's got a big shield.
She has a big shield. Oh, God. That's so how that, it
came. Well, it's also the anniversary. It's also, right, it's the anniversary celebration, in which, like, part of the anniversary celebration is all sorts of, like, wild, eccentric skins for the characters, in which like, look at them in thing that doesn't make that much sense, but is like funny relative to your expectations for the character. So like, that's the context in which a bunch of these, including the riot gear one, is coming in, is like, you know, trailers going out promising a bunch of skins that are like, you know, really strange and different, and eccentric.
Sure. Gotcha.
Yeah. It's also, I think there's a point where, at what point do you stop being surprised by Blizzard having these miscues, right? Yeah. Right? Like, I mean, famously you have the issue where, for all the diversity of heroes in there in Overwatch, for instance, like, black women strangely still not represented.
Heroes. And the way they step in it is they, I remember Gita Jackson at Kotaku wrote a piece, or maybe she just quoted it on Twitter, I can't remember exactly, but there was like a quote attributed to Jeff Kaplan, who's like the creative director or whatever of Overwatch. He's the person who's always in the videos. It was like, oh, we've been working, kind of tinkering with a character for like the last 5 years. It's like, excuse me? It's like, well, you know, we'll get around to putting a black woman in the game. And believe me, we've got sketches. Like, we've got it. It's like, okay, all right. You know, you could just put it in the game.
All right, Jeff.
Yeah. Right. And I think there's also sort of kind of a rolling clusterfuck around the character of Pharah. If memory serves, about them sort of playing around with different identities that they didn't have a super good handle on, and then retconning, like trying to cover their screw ups with character retcons that changed the character's like ethnic heritage and background. All to basically duck the fact that they had done some massively disrespectful and also clueless things around the idea of what Indian can mean.
Also just not fessing up to, like, look, you know, if being top of mind is like, we want to be more inclusive. And then when you do screw up, which like is not uncommon, right? Like it is appreciable that they're making the effort, but in the act of making the effort, I think part of the frustration of Blizzard is like them not owning up and like taking ownership of the mistakes, and instead just hand waving it and doing like kind of retconny stuff where it's okay, someone wrote a piece, pointed something on Reddit, like a little dicey, don't worry, we'll just figure it out over here, instead of like stepping up to the plate and like fully owning your mistakes as a way of taking ownership of it and trying to do better going forward. It's more just, of course there's something fucked up and wrong, and you know, they just kind of quietly edit it in the background.
Yeah. I should mention here, in addition to Dante's piece, which is on the site and you should read, Dia wrote a great piece. Dia Latina wrote a great piece on Medium. So you've officially made Pharah a native. If you want to sort of get caught up with, so how did that whole arc happen for Pharah? It sort of unpacks the loaded kind of imagery that Overwatch frequently traffics in without fully understanding like context. So it's weird.
Danielle, what else? What do you want to? You're around the Waypoint Vice games still, but you know you're still off doing other things. Like, what are some of the interesting stories that you've been working with that you want to shout out and point people towards if they're interested in following some of the stuff that you've been handling in other parts of Vice?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can find all of that at Vice Reports on Instagram. I know Instagram might be scary for you. You might call it the Gram. You might call it your IG, and it's all good either way. But we're doing some stories about teens who are attending the Stop the Bans rallies regarding abortion ban. The really fucked up things that are happening in various states across the country. We'll be having a couple of those going up in the next week or so, and we're also doing a lot of coverage. We're still accepting pitches around college advice, but those, like, if you're a recent college grad or a current college student, we're going to be doing a lot of college advice. We're going to be doing an entire summer full of college advice, things that people wish they knew going into college, which has been, by the way, just like a wild experience. We've got over 400 pitches for that, and some of them are a little hilarious and we're not going to use them, but some of them were like incredibly heartfelt, really, really beautiful. There was a pitch from somebody who, I won't name names or anything, but somebody who actually used going to college and going to nursing school as like sort of an excuse to get clean. They're an addict, and like, they were like, you know what? I just need something real intense and I want to help people. And they were like, I'm going to nursing school, which was like one of the most beautiful and moving things I've read in a really long time. So this is all to say at Vice Reports, we're doing a lot of interesting stories there. And also, of course, I'm still writing about games. So, you know, don't miss me too much. Yeah. I'm still here.
All right. Well, I think that is going to do it for this episode. I wanted to talk about this new fucking handheld with a crank, but we'll save that for next week. suffice to say, I am deeply interested in the weird gaming handheld with a crank that has a black and white screen and it's not backlit. What? Okay.
If you play Donkey Kong on it.
Wait, it's not backlit?
No.
God.
What?
Damn it.
My understanding is that you should think of the screen sort of like e-ink sort of thing. So that you need very little light for it to function. Like the kind of thing where you could have a desk lamp not particularly close to you and it'll still work, but it won't work in complete darkness. That is my what I have heard. I'm gonna have a longer feature about that up next week, so maybe we'll hold that till next week. But yeah, you can go read about Playdate, the new gaming handheld from Panic, up on the site now. But yeah, that's gonna do it for us. Danielle, I mean, you advice reports, but where else can people follow you?
Oh, you can find me at Danielle RI, and I will post a lot of pet pictures. And also jiu-jitsu things. So if you want either of those, you should follow me there too.
Kato.
At @A_Kato_appears on Twitter.
Nailed it. Rob.
At Rob Zachney.
You can follow me at Patrick Klubik. You can follow everything that Vice Games does at Waypoint. I don't know if I'll ever be able to say that with a straight face. Read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Our thanks to Bowen for the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. You can follow more of Bowen's work at waypoint.zone/Bowen. We'll be back on Monday, maybe with Austin?
Not Monday.
You know,
Monday's Memorial Day. Everyone's off.
Oh, yeah, we have a day off.
Fuck Mondays.
I'm going to the beach.
I don't know if we'll do a top of the...
Yeah, I don't know if we'll have... I don't know what we'll do next week. We'll figure that out.
I'm going to Michigan.
Yeah.
Rob, you're gone next week, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
To Michigan.
Yeah.
Enjoy Michigan.
Michigan's a beautiful state.
It is.
Yeah, Rob, Michigan's all right. So, yeah, we'll be back next week with a shorter week. We'll figure it out. I don't know exactly what we're going to do. We probably should... It's Thursday. We got time. We'll figure that out. But, you know, we've got Danielle. We've been struggling with these Friday podcasts when Danielle's not on. We don't know what to do. So thankfully, she is here. So Danielle, why don't you bring us home?
All right. Be good and be good at it.
Death to Jean-Claude.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Good.
Extremely good.
Good.
All right.
Good pod,
well,
good cool. pod. That was fun.
Yeah, good stuff.
Fun pod. Rob, I want you to know this. Yeah. I'm on the second to last episode of Revolutions season 3 on the French Revolution. I made it all the way at episode 53.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Damn.
Almost done.
I'm not that far. I am like midway through the Reign of Terror. But it's pretty harrowing.
Yup. I couldn't tell you 3/4 of what I've listened to, but I listened to it, and many of them multiple times. So I'm learning
things.
It's
a lot of French names.
It is, sure is.
Why are they called the Girondins? I don't know.
I truly have no idea. That one I could never figure out.
The what?
Girondins. And the
they're the people that have to get it in the neck for the Reign of Terror to really take off and the revolution to be secured.
Yep. And then for Napoleon to take it all. Take it all at the end.
Robespierre.
Maximilian Robespierre.
Guy's all right.
Yeah.
That's a word I know associated with the French Revolution.
He loses the thread a little bit. He's
basically out there saying, like, this is a bad idea. You don't want to create institutions with this kind of power. Is this the way you want the revolution to go? Really? All right.
Yeah.
And then they're like, all right, here, have dictatorial power. And he's like, let me be a case in fucking point.
Let me chop some strings.
I warned you, y'all.
Kind of,
I warned you about monarchy.
I think the Robespierre as performance art angle has been underexamined by historians. But, yeah.
Should I clap or?
Either one. I can clap. You can clap.
You're not here that often, Danielle. You can clap and you can pick the number.
You know...
You know, special privileges.
I feel truly special. Let's go on 43. Good?
Good.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Good clap.
Okay. All right.
No, I didn't make them big.
What? Excuse me, Kato?
It's okay.
I gotta make a big. You gotta make a big.
What?
Gotta big. Make a big.
Oh, man.
So I can see you a little better. I'm getting old, actually, you know?
This is probably not episode 237, right? It's probably
238.
Okay. All right. Three, two, one.